Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm very pleased today to welcome Professor Noam Chomsky to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. Described by the New York Times as arguably the most important intellectual alive, Noam Chomsky is a pioneering American linguist, philosopher, cognitive scientist, social critic, and political activist. Sometimes called the father of modern linguistics, Chomsky is also a major figure in analytic philosophy and one of the founders of the field of cognitive science. He has been a hugely influential figure in the international anti-war movement and an unrelenting critic of international power. In Manufacturing Consent, Chomsky, together with Edward Herman, skillfully analyzed the way in which the marketplace and the economics of publishing significantly shaped the news. He holds a joint appointment as Institute Professor Emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Laureate Professor at the University of Arizona, and is the author of more than 100 books on topics such as linguistics, war, politics, and mass media. Thank you very much, Professor Chomsky, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Very glad to be with you.
So there is no shortage of worrying environmental crisis at the moment. What's on your mind, Noam?
Well, it's not just the environmental crisis. That's severe enough. In fact, one of the lead authors of the IPCC report last year, which has since been updated and become more dire, opened a recent article by saying, let's not mince words. It's time to panic now. We're facing an imminent existential crisis. And unless something's done very fast, we're going to be finished, essentially. That's only one. We can come back to the details. There's another, which is equally serious, which is getting almost no attention, namely the crisis of the increasing threat of nuclear war. If you look over the record of the last 75 years, it's kind of a miracle that we survived, and it's now getting much worse. President Trump, as you know, has just dismantled one of the most important arms control treaties, the Reagan-Gorbachev INF treaty. That's gone. And to ram it home, Trump immediately, his administration immediately tested a missile which violates the treaty, virtually entreating the Russians to please match us and let's go on and work to murder each other. He's charged they will apparently destroy the Open Skies Treaty initiated by Eisenhower, which again has reduced threat seriously. And they've made it pretty clear that if reelected, they won't renew the Open START Treaty, the New START Treaty, which essentially ends the arms control regime. That's applauded by the weapons manufacturers, but for the rest of us, it means that the door is open to the United States, Russia, others to develop even more destructive weapons. Already we can destroy the world 1,000 times over and eliminate the barriers to use them. And then furthermore, tensions are developing, in the Middle East, for example, Trump's withdrawal, destruction of the joint agreement with Iran opens the door to a possible war simply by accident because of the tensions in the region, aside from other negative characteristics. all of this is happening right before us. Going back to the climate issue, which is extremely dire, but only one of a number of such threats, most of the world is doing at least something. It's inadequate, but something or other to deal with the imminent threat. The United States, the most powerful, privileged country in world history, is also doing something about it, namely under the Republican administration, is racing to catastrophe as with true dedication, supported, of course, by the energy corporations, which are happily opening up new areas to exploitation so that they can increase the production of fossil fuels, the big banks, which are pouring money into investments to support it, all supported by the Trump administration, which, and it's not just him, but the entire Republican Party, which is, as I've said before, has become the most dangerous organization in human history. Recently, incidentally, it's of some interest to see how it happened. So back, you go back to 2008, the Republican candidate, John McCain, actually ran on a program which included some insufficient, but at least some measures to deal with global warming. The party itself was considering cap and trade, other measures, again, insufficient, but at least something. When wind of this got to the Koch brothers, the huge private energy corporation, multi-billion dollar energy corporation, when news of this got to them, they were infuriated. They'd been trying for years to turn the Republican Party into a denialist party for obvious reasons. David Koch, one of the brothers, launched a huge juggernaut to try to force the party to reverse this mild deviation toward sanity. And then bribing senators, intimidating senators, huge lobbying campaign, concocting fake popular organizations to knock on doors and so on and so forth. Within a short time, the whole party capitulated. And now that's a mantra for the party that either nothing is happening, or maybe it is, but we shouldn't do anything about it, and let's just race to disaster. That's what the world is facing right now. An administration which is racing to disaster on two fronts. One, to destroy the environment in which organized human life can survive, and the other, to open the doors to the rapid escalation of the development of highly destructive weapons with, again, a race towards mutual destruction. Unfortunately, that's the world we're now living in.
Do you feel there's been a shift in awareness? We've seen it's been such a polarized landscape in America, particularly, I mean, in other countries too, particularly in America. We've seen, you know, Greta Thunberg, young people, Extinction Rebellion. It seems that something is afoot. Social protest is having an impact. Does that give you a little bit of optimism? How much can we achieve? How important is social protest?
Oh, quite a lot. In fact, just look at the record. I mentioned the Reagan-Gorbachev Treaty, 1987, INF Treaty, which did significantly reduce the threat of thermal war. You take a look at the background for that. The background was enormous public mobilizations and protests in Europe and in the United States against nuclear weapons development. Now, that created an environment in which the leadership could take important stands. And that can happen again. The climate strike last month was a real inspiring event. Maybe 7 or 8 million people seem to have been involved around the world, including the United States. The actions of Extinction Rebellion are extremely significant. In the United States, Sunrise Movement, a relatively small group of young people, was carrying out direct actions, including sit-ins in congressional offices, Nancy Pelosi's office. They got some support from the young representatives in Congress who had just been elected on the Sanders wave, the wave of popular activism that Bernie Sanders is responsible for. The main one was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, gave strong support to it, to Ed Markey, Massachusetts senator. And they managed to put on the legislative agenda something that's critically important and seemed unthinkable a year or two ago, namely some form of Green New Deal. Something like that has to be enacted, and enacted soon. And they made a huge step in that direction. Now, of course, it will be vetoed by the Republican Senate and the crazed president who are dedicated to destruction. But it's a step forward, and it can be carried forward even beyond. Even the Republican Party is not unreachable. After all, it was just one decade ago when they were moving towards a degree of sanity before they were often intimidated. So that change can happen. And it's not a matter of is it possible? It has to be possible. Going back to the article from the IPCC leader I quoted before, it is time to panic now. It's not just on the environment. Also on the enormous threat of nuclear war. There are other problems in the background which are serious enough, but these are the overwhelming and imminent ones. Unless we take care of these, nothing else is going to matter.
Yes, talking about this movement, and David Roberts in Vox wrote recently something that I was interested. He's saying that, you know, that the U.S. right will transition seamlessly from climate denialism to climate nationalism and fascism, acknowledge the threat and use it to justify exploiting U.S. fossil fuel reserves, building walls, shutting down immigration. And I guess underlying this is an idea that, you know, that things have shifted. It's really not so credible anymore to deny it. But actually, there are forces that would turn this in another direction that would say, well, yes, maybe it is happening, or it actually is happening and it's very worrying. But what we need to do is close down. We've got to stop immigration and things like that. Do you see that as plausible?
Well, it's happening, so it's plausible. The question is, can it succeed? Now, there is a general background that we have to be very clear about. You look all over the world, there's uprisings, anger, resentment, contempt for existing institutions takes different form in different countries, but the whole world is kind of aflame with this. Now, there are particular reasons in particular countries. So the reasons it's happening in Chile are not identical to the reasons why it's happening next door in Ecuador or across the world in Lebanon or Iraq. But there are some commonalities. They're very striking in the United States and the developed countries of Europe. This is all against the background of 40 years of economic and social policy, generally called neoliberalism, took off with Reagan and Thatcher, spread around much of the world. Its consequences were predictable, and we now see them very strikingly. The consequences of the policies were sharp increase in the concentration of wealth, pretty much stagnation for the majority. So real wages in the United States today are have about the same purchasing power as they did in the 1970s before the neoliberal assault began. Reduction of benefits exacerbated in Europe by the austerity policies in the continent. Of course, all of the obvious consequences of this concentration of wealth is almost indescribable. So in the United States by now, 0.1%, not 1%, 0.1% of the population has over 20% of the wealth. And over half the population has negative net worth, debts outweighing assets, meaning almost nothing to rely on if anything disruptive happens in life, an automobile accident or whatever. And furthermore, there's a lot of talk about unemployment, the employment and how low the employment is. That's highly misleading. For one thing, you're called employed if you work 1 hour a week. For another thing, studies have shown that people know it without the studies, that the job market has become much more precarious. So people are called employed if they have temporary jobs or jobs where they can be called by the employer and say, you can't work this week or you have to work double this week or you don't have any security. People are really living on the edge. The number of jobs with wages below the median or half has just increased very sharply in recent years. So when people talk, some talk about the average wage rising, but take that apart, what it means at the very top is huge increases, and down below there's stagnation or decline. This is the one or another form. This is the circumstance in which people are living around the world. It's fertile territory for demagogues who exploit scapegoats, typically people even more vulnerable than yourself. And here we're back to what you said, immigrants, African-Americans, Muslims, whoever the immediate target is. When people are angry, frightened, and resentful, it isn't hard for demagogues to plow that turf. I've seen it many times in the past. We're seeing it all over the world today. So, yes, the crises are very real. Attention is being diverted away from them towards scapegoats who are not the reason for the crisis, but are easy to denounce and attack. They're vulnerable. And that's unfortunately, that's the kind of situation we're looking at around the world.
You mentioned the Green New Deal. How important is the Green New Deal? It's been criticized by, I guess what you'd say, some predictable voices in America, that it's in the left-wing economic program, big government, putting everything under federal control. But you mentioned that this is quite an important move. How important is it?
Oh, it's very important. There is a massive propaganda trying to demonize the government. Back to Reagan's slogan, the government is the problem, not the solution. There's a footnote to that. If you diminish the role of government in decision making, you're increasing the role of someone else. It's not the population. You're increasing the role of unaccountable private power. They would be delighted to see the role of the government decline, except, of course, in serving them. They got to make sure that the government continues to devote itself to satisfying the needs of the very rich and corporate power, like Trump's tax cut, for example, and for them, not for anyone else. But the burdens have to be placed on the public. And the healthcare system, which is an utter scandal in the United States. It has about double the costs of comparable countries, and it has absolutely the worst outcomes. recent study in the Journal of the American Medical Association just confirms it again. As the highest mortality, the worst infant mortality, double the spending costs. Now, where is it going? It's mostly privatized system. So it's extraordinarily inefficient. Massive administrative costs, a huge amount of bureaucracy, huge salaries for the executives, monopolization, either both local and national, of major facilities. So in a particular locality, there'll be one, maybe two options for healthcare. They can, of course, raise the prices as they like and reduce the services as they like. The government supports huge profits for the pharmaceutical corporations. A lot of this is written into the fraudulent free trade agreements. They're not free trade agreements. They're highly protectionist, say, pharmaceutical companies and so on. The government supports them. All of this leads to enormous costs on individuals. Well, when rational proposals are introduced, like Medicare for All, the immediate cry is, oh, that's going to raise taxes, therefore we can't do it. Yeah, it'll slightly raise taxes, especially for the rich, but it will sharply cut costs for everyone else, for everyone. Even for the rich, it will cut costs. Although, you know, they'll pay a little bit in higher taxes. But once you say something is, it's going to be taxes, it's going to be government, then it's demonized. And you can understand very well why private power, private wealth, want to demonize the government. The government, with all of its flaws, is at least partially responsible to the general population. Unaccountable private tyrannies, corporations, they're not accountable at all. The big banks are not accountable. There's a lot of fraud about consumer democracy and so on. Forget about that. The facts are very clear. So going back to your point, yes, there's huge propaganda against big government, meaning against having the public have a say in decision-making. And the rich and powerful don't want that. Hard to explain why. And overcoming that massive propaganda is a very serious task. Actually, there's a point I'll have to leave in a minute, but there's a general point that's rarely discussed, although it's clear enough so that any child can understand it. The point is that the general public attitude towards taxes is a pretty good measure of how well democracies function. So let's imagine a society that's really a very well-functioning democracy. That means people get together, informed people get together, they deliberate, they decide on needs and wants that they have, they figure out ways to fund it, so it has to be funded, then the tax day comes along and they celebrate. It's a day of celebration. We've decided what we want, what kind of life we want, is our decision. We've decided how to pay for it, now we're doing it. What could be better? That's a functioning democracy. Let's take a society where taxes are hated and feared, where the slogans like the only things you can't avoid are death and taxes, where April 15th in the United States, the day you pay your taxes, is considered a day of mourning. Well, that's a society in which democracy is not functioning. You're having something imposed on you. That alien force out there called the government, which has nothing to do with me, is stealing my money. That's the opposite of democracy. Well, that's a pretty good way to measure the nature of functioning democracy in different societies. And it tells you something that's valuable to understand. So again, yes, there will be demonization of big government, namely of popular democracy, which is a call for not having the government act, but having private, unaccountable tyrannies run the country the way they pretty much do anyway, but even more.
Yeah, finally then. So besides government regulation, now, what potential is there to deal with untrammeled corporate power and the impact on the environment?
I mean, the corporate power is dedicated to destroying the environment. Suppose you're Jamie Dimon, the CEO of the biggest bank in the United States, J.P. Morgan Chase. What choices do you have within a system of basically business-run society, market-based business-run society? What you have is two choices. One, you can try to maximize profits, which means funding fossil fuel production, including the most dangerous, like Canadian tar sands. That'll increase profits. Your other choice is to say, I'm not going to do that, in which case you get kicked out or replaced by somebody else who'll do it. Now, that's implicit in the structure of the system. Now, it can be changed, but only by popular action to impose regulations and costs that are, in my opinion, to eliminate private power altogether. But that's another story and a different time dimension. Within the existing time dimension, there are many steps that have been taken. The sensible, detailed proposals for a Green New Deal are some of them, which would, even within existing institutions with their repressive and illegitimate hierarchic structures, even within that system, can modify, compel modification of behavior so that what are called externalities are not free. They have to pay for them. They have to reduce them. They have to eliminate. They have to impose emissions control. They have to move to net zero carbon emission and fast.
Yeah. In your earlier work, you highlighted the key role the U.S. government played in developing key Silicon Valley technologies, which then U.S. corporations privatized. Is there a role, what role for corporations in the Green New Deal? Is it okay for them to maximize their profits on the back of green policies?
Well, there has to be a place for them because they exist. And the possibility of moving to a different, a radically different social structure is simply on a, I think it's a desideratum. But it's, and we can be working for it. But the timeline is totally different from the timeline of what is required to deal with the origin crises. So it has to be done within the pretty much the framework of existing institutions. We just don't have the time. So yes, things can be set up so that corporations can become involved in, developing wind power, solar energy, and so on. But they have to be compelled by government power, which means popular political force, to modify their set of choices so that they will lead to a sustainable existence instead of destruction of organized human life. That can be done. The detailed Green New Deal proposals and the Salons, for example, and take this kind of thing into account. So there are, whatever one thinks about the desirability of eliminating existing repressive and hierarchic institutions, personally, I think that's a high priority, but whatever one's views on that, the existing crises have to be faced within the framework of existing institutions, modified and controlled by popular power. We just don't have choices about that.
Thank you so much, Noam. Have you some advice for individuals? We're all implicated via our personal consumption and our plastic bags, our driving, our carbon footprint. Clearly, that's part of the picture, and we can, you know, do important work there. But more broadly, at a social level, or what would you say to people?
Everyone has to be conscious of this. We have to modify and adjust their lives, not to a different kind of lifestyle, which I think is a preferable lifestyle. So, for example, there's nothing delightful about sitting for several hours a day in horrible traffic jams to try to get to work and back. It can be done efficiently and much more pleasantly with efficient mass transportation and a reduction in the use of automobiles. Okay, that's a change of lifestyle, but it improves lifestyle. Same thing if you if you weatherize your home, okay, save power bills, you live more comfortably. There's many things that can be done and have to be done, and we shouldn't think that they necessarily impose a burden. They might make life much more livable and decent, but it has to be done. However, individual choices, while important, don't measure up against the massive choices on a national and global level that must be undertaken. That's where the real burden is. So we can stop using plastic bags as we should in our own lives. But the real problem is to prevent Royal Dutch Shell, for example, to create a huge new production facility, as they're doing right now with great fanfare, to produce more non-biodegradable plastic bags. Now, the big problems are at the higher level. Individual choices make a difference, but participation in pocket popular activism, which will affect the major power systems, that's the primary goal.
That's a fantastic vision, and thank you so much, Noam, for all the work you've done, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.